Welcome to Bruderhof Radio. I am your host, Andrew Zimmerman.
In this state, under its constitution, a tax law to be constitutional must be applied equally throughout the state. That certainly should be the case when a life is to be taken.
Today on Bruderhof Radio, we look at the continuing struggle to abolish the death penalty in the United States, which remains one of the few nations still actively using capital punishment. According to Amnesty International's most recent figures, of the 2,500 executions worldwide in 1997, 85% took place in the United States, China, Iran, and Saudi Arabia. In other words, America's use of the death penalty places us in an exclusive category shared only by other major human rights abusers. To justify their position, opponents of the death penalty most often cite the Eighth Amendment, which prohibits cruel and unusual punishment, while supporters of capital punishment invoke the ancient biblical law of an eye for an eye. But putting these moral issues aside, human rights groups like Amnesty International have done much to point out the inconsistency and partiality in the application of capital punishment in America, where extreme class and race biases often affect who gets the death penalty and who doesn't. But the United States may finally be showing signs of vulnerability on this issue. In just a single week in May, the state of Maine rejected a bid to introduce capital punishment as state law, and the Nebraska state legislature approved a 2-year moratorium on executions. Although the governor of Nebraska vetoed the moratorium bill, the legislature was able to secure funding for a state crime commission investigation to study whether the death penalty is fairly administered in Nebraska. Bruderhof Radio spoke with two authors of the recent anti-death penalty legislation.
I don't believe that the state should kill anybody.
Ernie Chambers has been a Nebraska senator since 1970.
If there is to be a civilizing influence or force in society, the state has that responsibility. And as a society grows and matures, it ought to develop higher standards of conduct. And since the state ought to be the exemplar, if it wants to get across the notion that citizens should not settle differences by resorting to homicide, the state itself ought not do that, especially since a homicide is not a crime against the state itself. And in America, people who commit murders of the most heinous kind can be incarcerated under circumstances where they can't hurt anybody else. So I have always believed that under no circumstances should the state kill anybody, regardless of the identity of the perpetrator, the victim, or the nature of the murder. In view of the fact that, as I say, murderers can be kept away from other people, there is no justification whatsoever for the state to kill.
In other words, if it's wrong for a citizen to kill, it is wrong for the state to kill.
Absolutely, and especially during these days when so much is being said to the young people about resorting to violence, the children can pay attention to how many executions are occurring in this country, and some will even be aware of the fact that innocent people have been placed on death row, and we can conclude from that some innocent people have been executed. So when people want to discuss the types of signals that are sent by government, to put it in the way that you phrased it, the government ought to be an example of what it preaches.
Chambers' legislation originally called for the complete repeal of the death penalty in Nebraska, but political expediency forced him to settle for a 2-year moratorium on executions, during which the unfairness of capital punishment could be studied.
We amended it to call for a moratorium while a study of the death penalty was undertaken. I've been bringing this bill since I've been in the legislature, which is 29 years, and in 1979 the legislature did vote to abolish the death penalty, but the then Republican Governor Charles Thone vetoed it. In this instance, recognizing that politics is the art of the possible, the only thing possible to be gotten from the legislature this session was the moratorium, 2 years, for the study. The governor vetoed even that. In view of the fact that the study is to be based on all of the homicides that have been committed in Nebraska since the death penalty was reinstated, the data coming from those cases, which will deal with the circumstances surrounding the homicide, the race of the perpetrator, the victim, the charge that was filed, the charge that was actually taken to trial, whether or not there was a plea bargain, whether if a person were convicted of first-degree murder, he escaped the death penalty. All of these things can be determined based on hard data, and I'm sure that the randomness and arbitrariness will be so striking that something will have to be done about the way this penalty is administered in Nebraska. But since each county attorney in each of the 93 counties makes a determination as to whether a capital charge will be brought and carried to trial, there is no way to eliminate the randomness and the arbitrariness, because some counties will not allow the prosecution of a capital case because it's too expensive. In other counties, there are county attorneys who don't believe in the death penalty. So when these differences are built into the system itself, and a death law should be statewide, there is no way that it can be equitably and even-handedly applied throughout the state. In this state, under its constitution, a tax law to be constitutional must be applied equally throughout the state. That certainly should be the case when a life is to be taken.
Senator LaVon Crosby, who co-sponsored Chamber's legislation, says she finds the death penalty morally indefensible.
I am pro-life, to start with. And for me, life is a seamless garment. I don't know that society has the privilege of asking someone else to execute someone for us. We don't know why anyone's born. We don't know why anyone does the things they do. And so if there's some reason for those people to sit in the prison forever as an example or a statement as to what that murder is not a good thing to do, then I think that our taking the life of a person that has done that, the state taking the life, it just doesn't fit in with my pro-life vision. That's the reason. The other thing that's coming along, you see, is euthanasia. And that is, we have a hemlock society in Nebraska. Some of those people just drive me up the wall, because I think the assisted suicide is, that's horrendous.
One of the most egregious failures of the death penalty in the United States, say some critics, is its apparent targeting of minorities. A 1984 study, published by the Stanford Law Review, found that in cases of white homicide victims, the defendant was between 3 and 9 times more likely to receive a death sentence than in cases of black victims. And in 1994, the House Judiciary Subcommittee on Civil and Constitutional Rights reported that since 1988, 90% of federal death penalty prosecutions had a black or Hispanic defendant. Senator Chambers says this is not unexpected.
In any society where you have different races, the minority race, or the one deemed to be the weaker, is always going to suffer the brunt of the harsh punishments. If you look at society like a pyramid, those at the bottom are considered those having the least rights. The farther you proceed up that pyramid, the more lenient become the punishments until you get to the very top, where in effect no punishment is imposed at all. When you reverse the process and come down the pyramid from the top, the harsher become the punishments until you get to the bottom. Not only are harsh punishments imposed, they are unjustly imposed, and those who receive them are scapegoats more than anything else. The punishments imposed on those at the bottom would never be applied across the board.
According to Herbert Haynes, who teaches at the State University of New York in Cortland, the fight to end the death penalty is anything but recent. For the remainder of this program, we'll hear excerpts from a speech Haynes gave at a May 22nd abolitionist gathering called The Next Step.
If you prefer to think in terms of organizations, then you can probably trace your activist ancestry back to about 1842, when the first of the so-called anti-gallows societies was formed. That was in Philadelphia in 1842. There was also a national anti-death penalty organization that was formed about 3 years later, I think. It was called the Society for the Abolition of Capital Punishment. If it's the sense of moral outrage that counts rather than its organizational expression, and that's kind of where I tend to come down on these things, I tend to think that it's the spirit of a social movement rather than the organizations that make it up that really count. If it's the sense of moral outrage that counts, then we can trace our activist ancestry back a lot further than that. We can trace it back to the written and spoken words of people like Cesare Beccaria, Benjamin Rush, Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and a lot of other people of that particular era during the late 1700s. That's a pretty good lineage, if you ask me. I think that's something that we can look back on with a good deal of pride. These were all people who saw something evil about the institution of capital punishment, and to the best that they could in their day, they tried to do something about it. The fight to end executions has had its ups and downs. It's gone through several of what we sociologists like to call cycles of protest, waves of protest. I prefer to call them abolitionist eras in this case because, it seems to be more meaningful. The struggle against the death penalty has been through about three of these cycles, and I would argue that we're in the middle of a fourth. But it's been not only ups, but downs, peaks and valleys, highs and lows, and that's something that we have to keep in mind because I think it's instructive. I think it tells us some things that we really need to know. The first of these, just real briefly, was a period of time in the 1840s and the 1850s primarily. This was really the period of time when opponents of the death penalty didn't just speak out and write things, but they actually got organized and they formed structured groups and they tried in an organized way to lobby to either eliminate the death penalty or to reform it, and they tried very hard to educate people to change their minds about the necessity of the death penalty. And at that point in time, you know, people just couldn't conceive of a society in which you didn't use executions as a method of doing criminal justice. So they certainly were up against a lot. But these people accomplished things. This was an era when a lot was accomplished, at least given the possibilities of the time. By 1860, capital punishment had been abolished outright in three states, Rhode Island, Wisconsin, and Michigan. And another several states, 10 or so states, had de facto eliminated capital punishment by passing something that in those days they called the Maine Law. The Maine Law, named after the state of Maine, since it was the first to employ such a law, was essentially a law that required the governor of the state to issue a specific order that a convict be executed. And the governor could not issue that order sooner than a year after the trial had occurred. And the interesting thing that happened is that when you dumped it in the governor's lap in those days, governors were extraordinarily reluctant to be the one that issued that order that led to the death of a human being. Now, I worry that we've come a long ways from those days, because I don't think that governors, in effect, governors have to initiate the execution process today, and they're anything but reluctant to do it. So much for progress. But in any case, in those days, it had the effect of de facto eliminating the death penalty in several states. And the other thing that happened in those days, of course, is that public executions, which were the way executions were done back then, public executions began to drift off into history. States began to stop conducting their executions in public. Now, maybe that was a step toward civilization, and maybe it wasn't, because even today you have people arguing over whether hiding executions behind prison walls didn't just essentially make it easier for us to live with them. And I think it's entirely possible that it may have had that effect. But in any case, you've got to give credit to these early activists for what they were able to achieve. A second era of intense anti-death penalty activity took place beginning in about the 1890s. And I won't go into the reasons for why the first era died out and it took so long for the second to occur, because that's those historical details that I'm trying to avoid. But the second abolitionist era basically occurred 10 years either side of the turn of the century. And this one sort of rode on the coattails of some other movements that were happening at the time. For example, the progressive movements, which gave us pure food and drug laws and a lot of other reforms that happened, antitrust policies and so on and so forth. And again, there were some notable successes at this point in time, successes that have got to look very good to us today. There were 10 states that by the outbreak of World War I had abolished capital punishment in the United States. And in case anybody's interested, those 10 states were Colorado, Kansas, Minnesota, Washington, Oregon, North and South Dakota, Tennessee, Arizona, and Missouri. 10 states. Now, unfortunately, World War I came along, the Red Scares came along, which followed World War I, and most of the momentum that abolitionists had achieved by that point in time was lost. And it was a long time before the third cycle of protest. The third abolitionist era arrived, and when this was, this is when things begin to sound a little more familiar to most of us. The third abolitionist era began in the mid-1960s when attorneys with the NAACP Legal Defense Fund and the American Civil Liberties Union decided to try a different strategy. They decided, in effect, to take the executioner to court in hopes of getting the death penalty declared unconstitutional. And in a way, that approach was tremendously successful because it did, in fact, result in 1972 in that landmark Supreme Court decision in Furman versus Georgia, in which the United States Supreme Court justices, by the narrowest of margins, declared that the death penalty, as it was then being administered, as it was then being done, violated the 8th and 14th Amendments of the United States Constitution. And in effect, all that really did is make something official that had already been happening, because there hadn't been an execution in the United States in 5 years at the time that the Furman decision was handed down. And it wouldn't be an execution for another 10 years, but then, oh God, what happened then, right? Now, those are the ups. Again, alas, what happened after each one of these abolitionist eras, these cycles of protest, is that there were reversals in which anti-death penalty people, anti-death penalty forces, lost much of the ground that they had gained. For example, of the three states that abolished the death penalty outright during the pre-Civil War era, two of them fairly quickly brought the death penalty back. The one that didn't deserves mention here, and that's the state of Michigan. The state of Michigan has not had another execution to this day since they eliminated the death penalty in the 1840s. And just this year, the Michigan legislature again turned back intense pressure to bring the death penalty back in the state of Michigan. And we do have victories from time to time, and it seems to me that that's one of them. The 10 states that abolished the death penalty during the second abolitionist era, they all quickly brought it back. And of course, as I think most of us know, what happened after the Furman decision, only 4 years after the Supreme Court ruled the death penalty to be a violation of the 8th and 14th Amendments of the Constitution, they reversed themselves. They declared that a lot of these new and improved death penalty laws that the state legislatures had rushed back to write after the Furman decision, they ruled that at least some of those were permissible, and so the death penalty was allowed to come back in sort of a modified form. Now, most of us, all of us, looking back on that, realize that most of the so-called improvements that the states used to get their death penalty laws to pass constitutional muster really weren't improvements at all. But in any case, that's what happened. And since that time, by the way, 544 lives have been taken in American death chambers, and this year is looking to be a particularly bloody one because there have been 43 executions just since January. So we have our work cut out for us. Now, one of the lessons to be learned from this, which is what I really wanted to say, is it seems to me that we probably had better get used to the fact that we may never defeat the death penalty once and for all. We'd probably better get used to the idea that the fight we fight is going to be a never-ending fight, because the death penalty has a way of coming back. And we're going to have to keep fighting it permanently, and our children are going to have to keep fighting it permanently, and their children, I suspect, unfortunately, are probably going to have to keep fighting it permanently. It's never going to end. And it seems to me that another lesson that we can learn from this, it sort of goes along with the fact that we may never defeat the death penalty once and for all, is that we've got to be very, very careful not to get discouraged, because it is so easy to get discouraged when you're trying to do this thing and to get rid of the death penalty. When I get discouraged, what I try to do is to think back on somebody that I learned about in learning a little bit about the history of the death penalty. This is a woman that I don't know how many of you would even recognize this name, but her name was Sarah Ehrman. How many of you know who Sarah Ehrman is? I'm just curious. Does that name ring a bell with anybody? Find out about Sarah Ehrman, because she's a fascinating woman. Sarah Ehrman was the wife of one of the defense attorneys in the infamous Sacco and Vanzetti trials in Massachusetts back in the 1920s. And because her husband was one of the defense attorneys in that case, she learned an awful lot about the death penalty in a short time, and it caused her to become very outraged about it. Sarah Ehrman put her outrage to work. She formed not one but two anti-death penalty organizations in a very inhospitable time to be doing that. She formed the Massachusetts Council Against Capital Punishment, and then later the American League to Abolish Capital Punishment, the League as it was known for a very long time. And there were times when the League was doing a lot of work, but I tell you something, there were other times, lots of years, when the American League to Abolish Capital Punishment consisted of Sarah Ehrman sitting at her dining room table in Brookline, Massachusetts, on a shoestring budget, trying to do it on her own. And she never quit. And she kept doing what she could to fight against the death penalty. And finally, that third era of abolitionist activity arose in the 1960s, and she was there to greet it, and she was there in some ways to help it form. So, you know, when we think we've got it tough, think about Sarah sitting at that dining room table being, in effect, the anti-death penalty movement all by herself. The interesting thing when you look back at the issues that have been raised and the arguments that have been raised against the death penalty, you discover that some of the issues have remained the same for a very long time, and some of them haven't. For example, issues like deterrence, you know, does the death penalty deter potential killers? This is something that people on both sides of the death penalty have been arguing about since the 1840s. I mean, it was just as common to hear people arguing about deterrence in the 1840s as it is to hear people arguing about it these days. Now, these days, we, of course, have 50 years of accumulated research that pretty much proves, at least to my satisfaction, to most people's satisfaction, that the death penalty does not do anything to make us safer. But that, of course, doesn't keep tough-on-crime politicians from continuing to talk as though it does. Nevertheless, the deterrence issue is one of those issues that has continued to be argued about cycle after cycle, decade after decade, year after year. So have the fundamental moral issues. If you go back to the 19th century, you're going to find one side arguing that justice requires that when someone takes a human life, they deserve to have their own life taken. You have someone else arguing, as most of us in this room would, that two wrongs don't make a right, and that capital punishment doesn't do anything but lower us down to the level of the killer. But again, it's been an ongoing theme in this thing for a very, very long time. Some of the other issues, on the other hand, have changed. And just to give you one example of an issue that I think has changed considerably, there's several that have risen to the fore, but one that I'm sorry to say I think has faded has to do with the religious issues involved in the death penalty. There was probably no single question about capital punishment that was more central to the debate about the death penalty in the 19th century than how it fit with God's will. Fans of the death penalty, like some of the people that we heard about who were confronting the Children's March and that we saw in the video out in the lobby, have argued for a very long time that the Old Testament is full of numerous approving references to the death penalty, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, whoso sheddeth man's blood, so shall his blood be shed, and so on and so forth. Whereas opponents of the death penalty have tended to cite the New Testament, the story of Cain, and all the other evidence in there and passages in the Bible that to most of us very clearly speak against the death penalty. But I think that whether we like it or not, the religious dimensions of the death penalty have tended to fade somewhat, and other issues have tended to rise. And the point, I think really the meaning of this and what really matters about this is that the history of the death penalty debate, it seems to me, teaches us that this is a battle that we have to fight on shifting terrain. And that what we have to do as we take our next steps against the death penalty is we have to try very hard to see that our tactics and our arguments and our strategies are appropriate to the current cultural and political climate. One of the things, frankly, that breaks my heart about the state of death penalty politics is that I'm afraid we're in a situation right now where most Americans simply are not ready or willing to talk very seriously about many of the fundamental moral dimensions of the death penalty. We live in a culture of violence. We live in a culture in which we're saturated with violence. We are entertained by violence. And so consequently, when abolitionists come along and try to get people to take seriously the idea that the death penalty is morally wrong, that it's morally wrong for the state to take life, a lot of times we find that we're up against a very major roadblock in that regard. It seems to me that what the next step needs to be, at least in terms of the political side of this thing, is that we have to look very, very hard at what political scientists call the wedge issues. We have to look for issues that are capable of making people who are kind of in the middle on the death penalty. I'm not talking about the people that are hardcore supporters of the death penalty, because they may, in many cases, be almost beyond our reach. But most Americans aren't hardcore supporters of the death penalty. Most Americans simply haven't thought about it very much. And I think what we need to do is we need to be looking very hard for issues that sort of force people to think about the death penalty in a way that they hadn't thought about it before, and then to figure out how to articulate those issues so that they resonate, so that people don't just listen and it goes in one ear and out the others, but they stop and they think, and then hopefully they act. And I'm thinking, and I could be wrong, but I'm beginning to think that the wedge issue of the closing years of this millennium may turn out to be the innocence issue. Because again, as you've heard already this morning, in the state of Illinois, they've had to let 12 people go in the last 12 years because they were serving time on death row, and son of a gun, it turned out they didn't do it. And the last one, I guess, was just last week. There have been 79 such cases in the United States nationally since the death penalty came back. I think Americans are ready to tolerate the death penalty when they don't think about it very hard, but I'm not convinced that they're ready to tolerate the execution of innocent people.
As Herbert Haines has illuminated, the fight against capital punishment can often be disheartening. But Senator Chambers of Nebraska refuses to give up, even though the polls show the majority of Nebraskans and Americans support capital punishment. Does your constituency support your fight against the death penalty?
I hope they do, but whether they do or not, it's something that I must do. When I was elected, I was not elected to reflect ignorance, but to study the issues, get the best information I can, then employ my best judgment. So that's what I do, and if the people who vote for me agree, they'll send me back to the legislature, which they've done all these years. When they disagree strongly enough, they'll send somebody else.
So no matter what other people think, you're going to keep fighting against the death penalty in Nebraska as long as you are in office?
Oh, absolutely. There's no question about it. I am unwavering. I am unchanging on that issue.
More of Professor Haines' speech, along with other testimonials by well-known abolitionists collected at the Next Step conference, is available on video from Plow Publishing. To order copies, call 800-521-8011. And that's all for this edition of Bruderhof Radio. Bruderhof Radio, which is produced by Andrew Zimmerman, is a project of the Bruderhof Communities, a communal movement based on Christ's Sermon on the Mount. In particular, the teachings concerning brotherly love and love of enemies, mutual service, nonviolence, and the refusal to bear arms. Instead of holding assets or property, we share everything in common, and each member gives his or her talents, time, and effort wherever they are needed. To obtain more information about Bruderhof Radio or the Bruderhof Communities, call 914-658-8351 or write to Woodcrest Bruderhof, Rifton, New York, 12471.